Welcome to Element. If you are new, there are Bibles in the seat backs in front of you. If you don't own one, you can have one. If you forgot one, you can use one. There are sermon notes on the communion tables around the room. They look like this. On the front side, you get a one-paragraph recap of what we will talk about today. Underneath that, you'll get the verses that we're going to kind of run through. You get a place for notes. And on the back, you get some questions to reflect on what we talk about today. And on the bottom, there's also a little activity as well as you head into this Christmas season. If you have a smart device, you can download an app. It is called YouVersion. Click on More and then Events in YouVersion. We will come up by GPS in your smart device. You will get sermon notes, verses, questions, announcements, all that goes with today's message. My name is not Donald Weedy. My name is Aaron. I am one of the pastors at Element. Why don't you stand with me for the reading of God's Word? This is Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, and it says this. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." Let's pray. Father, this morning we ask that you would move us to a deeper understanding of what it means that you are the true king, and that your rule and reign, it never ends, it never ceases, and you have come to restore and invite us into your kingdom and your family. And so I ask that throughout this Christmas season, we'd remember that, and we would walk with you and show others the great goodness that you have bestowed into our lives, we would extend to those around us. Amen. Have a seat. So we're doing this series for, I was going to say a short series, like 4 weeks, but then we are doing one of these on Christmas Eve, and then we're doing one the week after Christmas, and then one the week after New Year's. So I said four, but it's really like 7 weeks, which is still a short series for us, but we're calling it The Carols. And I keep saying maybe The Carols was not a great name for the series, because when you hear The Carols, you think of carols in your life, like your favorite barista carol or your Aunt Carol or something like that. When I talk about the carols, I'm talking about the songs that we sing at Christmas, Christmas carols. We live in a day where there is a cultural Christmas that really doesn't know anything about Jesus. And then you have what we want to focus on, which is Jesus during this holiday season. And one day, hopefully, that will come together. But that day is not today. But there are these songs that are sung that go out there, and they play over the speakers at the Target, at the Walmart, at the Christmas tree farm, and there's songs about God's grace and his goodness and his peace. And most people hear a sermon sung to them and they're not even realizing it. Your kids may be in a public school and do a Christmas program, and some of these songs get sung. And so you might be able to have a conversation that's more, "Hey, wasn't that fruitcake great?" which no one ever said. But you could say, "Oh, I heard about this song," and maybe you could have a discussion about that. So we're not spending time with the holly jolly Christmas kind of stuff. Not that that's all bad. It just doesn't have some deep meaning as some of the deep Christmas carols, like Deck the Halls, right? Fa-la-la-la-la. That was actually a Welsh song, and it was called Nos Galan, and you would not sing that in front of kids because it was full of adult words. Adult words? Naughty words. I don't know, but you wouldn't sing that. You know, there's, in the 19th century, there's a guy named Thomas Oliphant. He came and he rewrote all the words, kept the fa-la-la-la-la, and lo and behold, you had a new Christmas song. We Wish You a Merry Christmas. They started that under Tudor monarchs, and they would go around and sing songs to different houses, and people would give them food or drink or figgy pudding. But I'm not talking about that, because that doesn't have spiritual significance. I'm not trying to say, like, run, run, Rudolph is like running from your sin. What we want to talk about is the deep carols that we sing, specific ones, because maybe we could close the gap between what we sing about at Christmas and what we understand about Christmas, those things coming together to help us to worship God in greater ways. So today, we're going to kind of hit and talk about two different Christmas carols. We just sang one called Do You Hear What I Hear? That's written by a guy named Noel Regney. He actually wrote that during the Cuban Missile Crisis when he wanted people to focus on the birth of Christ and not upon all these politics, which is tearing the world apart. And we're also going to talk about We Three Kings. Though the number isn't actually correct, it does have deep theological significance. One of the interesting things about We Three Kings is it puts the USA on the map. It was written here. It's, there you go. Woo! Yeah, be happy about that. It is also the one carol with the most inaccuracies. So go America. But We Three Kings is depicted like in all these movies about little kids and crowns, and they're going, you know, to worship the king. It's written by a guy named John Henry Hopkins Jr. He was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, home of the manliest football team ever, the Steelers. You can, You can disagree, but you'd be wrong. Okay. So again, don't break out in chants of USA because it is the one with the most inaccuracies. But the ultimate point is right on. And the ultimate point comes in the middle of the song, and it will say, King forever, ceasing never. And that's kind of the point. That's the big idea today. Jesus is the King forever that never ceases. And if we understand that, that's going to affect how we live in our lives. So the concept is we will give our lives to something. And Jesus is the King who has come and given himself for us. And so we want to give ourselves to him. The only non-religious song I almost did during this series was John Lennon's So This Is Christmas, So What Have You Done? It's a great question as you end 2024, because what do we give our lives to this year? What was it worth it as it winds down? What do we spend the most money on? You know, what became worthy of our life? Was it a job, a relationship, a child coming into your life, or was it Jesus? Like last week, we talked about there are lots of things that we get to celebrate. That we look at God and say, God, we are so thankful for all of these things, but we shouldn't worship those things. What we want to do is we want to worship Jesus. What is worthy to give our lives to in worship? And that's Christ. And so that goes to the King forever, who ceases never. So I was listening to this guy tell this story that got me thinking about this. And he talked about how his son really liked the movie Cars. Came out years ago, so you know, no spoilers in this. But the main character in the movie is called Lightning McQueen. But his son's favorite character was not Lightning McQueen. It was Doc Hudson. And Doc Hudson, he's a former dirt track racer. It's a cartoon, by the way, so just think of Cars being Cars if you haven't seen the movie. He's a dirt track racer. He becomes the Radiator Springs judge and doctor. Spoiler, I don't think he even makes it to Cars 2. But this kid, about 4 years old, goes to their church on a Christmas Eve, sees the nativity scene. He's holding on to his Doc Hudson. He drives Doc Hudson up and looks through the window with Doc Hudson and runs Doc Hudson over the wise men because this church wasn't biblically accurate. And he takes the wise men, runs around Mary and Joseph. And eventually what he does is he pulls the baby Jesus out of the manger scene and he puts Doc Hudson in the place of baby Jesus. And he said it took the people a couple hours before they realized that everybody in the manger scene was worshiping Doc Hudson and not Jesus. And it's kind of funny, but I think, oh my goodness, we're a lot like that four-year-old boy. Every single one of us. We have something we love and adore, and it slowly moves closer to the place of Christ in importance until we replace him with that thing. And sometimes it's weeks or years before we even notice that we have exchanged the truth of God for a lie. And so this morning, what I want us to do is see Jesus in a greater way, maybe see the things that we have moved into our hearts into that place of Christ, maybe put our Doc Hudson there, and realize what that is. If you have a Bible, open to Matthew chapter 2. It is on page 523, if you're going to use one of the Bibles in the seat backs in front of you. And so last week I told you, I'm not going into all the details of the Christmas carol songs. I'm going to rely on your cultural knowledge of the song, like the King forever, ceasing never part. But I want to talk about the scriptures that inspire these songs, John Henry Hopkins, Noel Rigney, you know, what inspired them. So first off, we're going to talk about King forever. Matthew chapter 2, starting in verse 1, goes like this. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea in the days of Herod the king, that phrase, the days of Herod the king, that's not a calendar statement, that though it is, but it's telling you who was ruling and reigning when Jesus showed up. Here's some history. Rome gave Herod the title King of the Jews. That is a formal title. It's a legal title. Herod loved that title. Herod would do anything to retain that title for himself as king. So racially, he's a Moabite, so he's part Arab, part Hebrew. Religiously, he's Jewish. Culturally, he is Greek. He spoke Greek. Politically, he always sided with Rome. He loved power. He loved success. Depending on which historian you read, he was married to 10 or 11 women and had 43 children. He had one wife that historians agree that he loved. Her name was Miriam, but he got suspicious of her, so he had her killed and had her mother killed, and then had two kids that she birthed for him killed. He had a barber that stood up for these children. He had that barber killed. Herod, okay? Herod also liked to call himself the Great. Herod the Great. I mean, that's like talking about yourself in third person. Who are you? I'm Herod the Great. The Great. Have you met me? I'm great. That's Herod. He also taxed the people in Israel into homelessness or unhousedness. I don't know how you're supposed to say it today. Whatever. So anyway, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men came from the east to Jerusalem saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? If you're Herod, what's your response? Wait, that's me. That's me. I'm the king of the Jews. What do you mean? What you talking about, Willis? What's going on? Like, what's happening here right now? Only some of you will get that. Okay, he says, for we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled and all Jerusalem with him. So Jerusalem is disturbed because if Herod's disturbed, you're disturbed. And if something is going on in Jerusalem where Herod might lose his power, you get a little bit worried about that. Herod keeps his power because of Caesar. You keep your privileged place because of Herod. And if there's a true king that is born of king of the Jews, well, that will spell some trouble for you. Verse 4, and assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Herod wants this potential rival removed. Where is he? Where is he at? But he's thwarted in his attempts to find out where this baby is born, the king of the Jews. And so what he will eventually do is find the region, and he will kill every baby in this region that is born that was under 2 years of age. That's what Herod does. So instead of rejoicing in the king, Herod reacts out of fear because he thinks he's going to lose all that he holds dear. Someone's going to come and take his Doc Hudson away from him. And so what do we hold dear that we are afraid to give up to Christ, the true king, when he shows up? Because there are a lot of people today who say, I'm going to surrender my life to Christ, but not that thing, not this thing over here. This is the thing I'm going to hold so dear to my heart. Herod is exactly like that. If you follow Jesus, it costs you everything. It really does. And so Herod knows that, and he looks for a way to get rid of Jesus. Instead of bringing gifts like the wise men in the scriptures and like the kings in the song, his gift that he brings is death. Think about this. What gifts do we bring? Not that we have anything we can give to Jesus for our salvation, but what gifts do we bring to Christ? Is it our very lives, or is it something a little bit less? Something that's just a little bit easier for us to maybe give up. We three kings in the song, it addresses the hardship that they went to present themselves to this king. We three kings of Orient are bearing gifts, we traveled afar. The first part of that, not even historical at all. The second part is pretty good. Bearing gifts, we traveled afar. Someone once asked, where is Orient R? Is that where they played the last World Cup? The place in the song is one of the many inaccuracies of the song, but Matthew's words nail this down. He says, behold, wise men from the east came. But because we don't understand the cultural things that Matthew looked at, we go, well, where's the east? What does that mean? Chad Ashby, who is a commentator, he wrote this. His description is so utterly specific that church traditions in dozens of countries claim to be their country of origin. So if you lived in Matthew's day, you would know exactly what he was talking about. Because the wise men from the east, that would mean from Persia, modern day Iraq or Iran, and they aren't kings. So what are these wise men? What are they coming from? Why are they even doing this? Well, when you think of wise men, think of a magician. Not like David Blaine, but think of like a priest astrologer. Also, there's not three of them. They brought three gifts. I can give three gifts to my wife at Christmas. It does not mean there are three of me. Thank God, right? Yeah, okay. So they traveled probably 800 miles over the course of months to get to where they are, which means it's most likely a very large caravan. And when they show up, Jesus isn't a baby sitting on his mother's lap. He's a child. The child. Let us bring him silver and gold. So Matthew chapter 2, verse 10. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going to the house, no room in the inn, not the cave, not the manger, the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshiped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. So they come not to where he was born, but where the family is currently living. And if you have a nativity scene with wise men in it, you know, why did I spend so much money on those wise men? What am I doing? So, you know, when we look at this, there's a lot of good things because you don't need to scrap the song, We Three Kings, because the important part is what they came to do. Fall down and worship the King forever who ceases never. They're exceedingly glad. They gave their best to him. They went through difficult hardships in their life to move to that place to say, you are the King. And we could all learn from that. And I don't want to overwhelm you with too much history, but there's whole bunches of little things throughout the scriptures that kind of point to what's going on here. And it starts all the way back with talking donkeys and prophecies and a guy named Balaam. Balaam is a guy that pagan kings, when the Israelites were wandering around the desert, pagan kings were like, we need to stop those people. And they took this guy named Balaam and they paid him money to curse the Israelites. And every time he tried, God wouldn't let him speak negative words. He started speaking all these great prophecies about what's going to happen to Israel and what's going to come out of this people. Numbers 24, verse 17, Balaam will say, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob. A scepter shall rise out of Israel. And so you have these prophecies by even these pagan prophets that God is like going, nope, you're not going to curse them. You're going to say this. Balaam was a total tool, by the way. Lots of stories about him. But anyway, I think this is something that these wise men have been watching and waiting for. How did they know? Maybe how to interpret some of this. Leads to another guy named Daniel. We'll probably do a series on him in a couple years. That's how I plan, by the way. Daniel, as a child, was taken by a Babylonian king as a captive. He was trained in the courts of how to be a wise man, one of these like magi that come to worship Jesus. But Daniel doesn't fall into all of the divination. What he does is he worships God and has this respected position because he trusts in God. So how this kind of happens is you have the crazy king of Babylon. His name is Nebuchadnezzar, and he has a dream one night. And he brings in his religious consulting community, the wise men, and he says, tell me what the dream was about. And they say, tell us the dream and we'll make something up. No, they don't, it doesn't actually say that, but that's what's going on. And he goes, no, you tell me what I dreamed. And then tell me what it means. And they're like, oh, and then he says, and if you don't, Daniel 2 verse 5, you shall be torn limb from limb and your houses shall be laid in ruins. No pressure, okay? Daniel chapter 2 verse 10, the Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. No great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. They have a religious understanding in this world that wherever the gods or God is, he does not reside with human beings. And so Nebuchadnezzar basically says, stinks to be you, you better go figure it out. So you have to see this whole political religious structure. The book of Daniel is really about who has ultimate control. And so Daniel and his friends, God will reveal the dream, reveal the interpretation to the dream. They will step up. They will save all the wise men, which you think would make them thankful, but it doesn't. It just makes them jealous because Daniel gets promoted. But in the beginning, you have this whole thing of the gods do not live among human beings, period. Now, eventually what happens is the Babylonians will be overtaken by the Persians. Daniel will keep his respected position because whenever you took a country, if they had wise men, it's like, oh, they're impartial. I need more wise men. The more wise men you had, the more powerful you were. So Daniel kept his privileged position. The wise men, when you get into Persia, they called their wise men magi. And that is the word that Matthew will use in the text when he talks through this. These magi, this is where they came from. When we hear the words wise men or magi, we think, oh, the birth of Jesus and the three gifts and the camels and the donkeys and all that. When they, at this time when Matthew wrote this, they heard those words, they would think Persia. They would think Babylon. They would think, again, where modern Iraq or Iraq is, they would look that. They would even think maybe of Daniel himself. These wise men, back in Babylon, they say to the king, no one can show it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. Daniel will say, Daniel 2, verses 27 and 28, no wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show the king the mystery that the king has asked, but there's a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. and at the birth of Jesus. You have these wise men coming from Persia, and they see the fact that something amazing has now happened. What is that? Against all reasoning, God has come to dwell among human beings. God has come in this baby in Christ. That's why they show up. Let us see this astounding thing that the Lord has done. And they find Jesus. They bow before him as a Hebrew. I know it doesn't blow your mind, but that's huge. And they herald him as a king. At Jesus' birth, all the tables have been turned of how everybody thought how the world worked. They do not find a man seated at the right hand of Herod or Nebuchadnezzar or Darius. They find a child seated on his mother's lap. And what do? They give him these three gifts. This is also really important. In 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 7, there is a queen from a place called Sheba. She goes to the king of Israel at the time, a guy named Solomon. She asks him a bunch of questions. He answers these questions. And after he answers them, she's like, wow, you have a lot of wisdom. It is the Lord, the God of Israel, who is to be blessed and praised, that made you king over Israel. And then what she does is she will lay before him gifts, gold, spices, precious stones. This is what people did in that age when they honored a king. This is how they said, you are a king and you are greater than I. The wise men come to Jesus. What do? They lay these gifts that were typical in that culture, in that age, to say, you are a king. You are greater than I. Gold, frankincense, myrrh. There's so much speculation today about what those gifts actually mean. Like, some people will say gold reflects the worth of Jesus, but also the needed funds because the family's going to have to run from Herod because he's sneaky and he followed the wise men to find out where Jesus was. Frankincense, they say this is an incense and it resembles our prayers that go up before God. Myrrh is also used, they say, as an embalming fluid, and it foreshadows Christ's death. Okay, is that true? I don't know. I really don't. I don't have any opinion on the matter whatsoever. I mean, maybe God, after the cross and resurrection, intended for us to see that. But I'll tell you, the wise men didn't see that. The wise men, what they came to do is lay these gifts before a king, to acknowledge him as a king, because they realize someone greater than Solomon, Darius, Herod, Nebuchadnezzar is here. God has become flesh. The king forever has actually shown up. And they bow down. And they worship him. Now, if you go back to the scene in Matthew, this isn't like Silent Night. All is not calm. All is not bright. The child did not sleep in heavenly peace. There is a price on his head. And right after the wise men show up and they give these gifts, an angel will show up to Joseph in chapter 2, verse 13. And he will say, rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. Think about Joseph. We always talk about Mary and all that. Think about Joseph. What's his first Christmas? I mean, he was there. Boom, baby came out. Christmas, right? He's there. At his first Christmas, he lost his reputation as a righteous man because people thought either he got Mary pregnant and they were lying about it, that, oh, it's not Joseph's, or Mary is pregnant in some other way and Joseph's the dummy who believed her. And so he marries this harlot. He loses his reputation. At this second, third Christmas, I mean, think about this. The angel shows up. Okay, Joseph, now you're going to lose your home, your job, your country, your people. You're going to take your wife and this little child that you are adopting, and you're responsible for them, and you're going to live as a refugee in a hostile country that's hostile to you as a Jew. That's how the king forever shows up. Jesus could have come as a Herod. He could have come as whatever he wanted, but he comes in this because he's always subverting these power dynamics. That's how the king forever comes. Now, let's move to the ceasing never. That was the longer part, don't worry. The ceasing never part, okay? There's a biblical title here that I don't see in a lot of devotional booklets. Matthew mentions in this story over and over, and this goes to where, do you hear what I hear? See if you notice, okay? Starting in verse 8, go and search diligently for the child. Verse 9, the place where the child was. Verse 11, they saw the child with Mary his mother. Verse 13, take the child, escape to Egypt. Verse 14, he arose and took the child. Verse 20, take the child and go to the land of Israel. Verse 21, so he arose and took the child. The child, the child. Shivers in the cold letters. Do you see it? The child, why, why? Because in the ancient world, people weren't sentimental about children. They didn't. If you had a child and you didn't want it, you would just stick it outside and let it die. Nobody cared. That's what you would do. after Jesus comes, because of how he viewed children, it changed our entire view of kids. Like today, we are horrified when people hurt children. Back in that day, it wasn't a big deal. Jesus changes our mindset. The church starts orphanages to care for these children. And so you see everything begin to change with Jesus. To be a child was to be dependent, defenseless, fragile, vulnerable, at risk. But this child that comes is going to save his people from their sins. And when you look at this, it's simply astounding. God comes utterly vulnerable, at risk, defenseless. One person writes this: Jesus is God exposed to all the evils in the world so it might do its worst to him. And think about this. If you're at Christmas this year and you feel like you're vulnerable and weak and you feel helpless, you don't have enough strength to make your life look like the postcard, Jesus relates. He understands because he was there. His family was there. We are told in Hebrews 4, verses 14 through 16, "Since then we have a great high priest who has been passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God. Let us hold fast to our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in our time of need." See, ceasing never, when you look at this, it means that in Jesus' day and all the way to ours, God is still at work in real ways. In Bethlehem, in Israel, in Egypt, in our life today. Part of Matthew's wonderful, deep, and I would say even dark story is that with Jesus, the King forever who never ceases, there is no trial or expression of evil that goes on forever. Jesus steps in. And he makes a difference in real ways. In Matthew chapter 2, verse 19, it's like Matthew now moves the story in a whole new way. And this is what he says in chapter 2, verse 19. "But when Herod died..." So the chapter starts out during the time of King Herod. How does he move the chapter? "But when Herod died." In fact, Matthew will mention three times that Herod is dead in chapter 2 alone. What does Matthew want you to know? Herod's dead, right? Not a trick question. Great, perfect, right? That's what I said. Herod's dead. Herod could have been the one who welcomed Jesus. He could have been the one that said, "Hey, King of the Jews," and proclaim him to the world. But Herod wants to be king. That's what he wants to be. And Matthew wants you to know that Herod the Great, with all of his power, with all of his privilege, with all of his glory and his throne and his crown, Herod the Great is now Herod the Dead. Because Herod is not the king forever, and neither are we. Jesus is the King forever. What I want us all to understand is that how we respond to Jesus is the most important thing in the world. How did the three kings, the wise men, respond to Jesus? They bowed their lives knowing something greater than them was there. The Magi bow. Herod says, "I want to be king. I want this world to be about the project of Herod the Great." And Matthew kind of asks, which road are we on? We're either on a road that's going to lead to the place where we're on our knees before the king, like the wise men, because they were wise, or we're going to be in a road that ends in our grave. Herod died. Here's another one. Who else is going to die? Us. Yeah, again, not a trick question. Okay, not us, right? Everybody in this room. But Jesus ceases never. I have this clock in my office. One hand says, "Remember," the other one says, "You will die." And I know it sounds kind of morbid and weird. I love it, though. Because when someone says, "What time is it?" I'm like, well, I'm still alive, but I got to remember, I'm going to die. And it's kind of healthy, I think. My wife doesn't like when I talk like this, but, you know, I love it because it reminds me. It's not about me. Matthew's using this subtle message. What time was Jesus born? Herod's time. He's the king. But remember, Herod's going to die. Herod thinks he's great. At the beginning of Matthew 2, he will deliberately call Herod the king like three times. Herod the king, the king, Herod the king. You'll see this. Then the Magi show up. They go and they lay their gifts before Jesus, and it's like a coronation. It's like saying, "This is the real king of the Jews. There is a new king in town." And from that point on, Matthew does not call Herod king anymore because there is a different king. Herod's going to die. You are going to die. Jesus knows what it is to be vulnerable and to be hurt and be hated, and he will die, but he will also rise and be the king forever that ceases never. And he doesn't come in and save us always from our circumstances, but he walks with us through them. He saves us in those circumstances. And We Three Kings reminds us to ask, who is our king? Is it our circumstance? Is it our wealth, our relationships, our identity? Or is it Jesus? Because there is something in our lives that every single one of us pursue. And we move it to the center of our life. We think that thing's going to bring me rest. That thing's going to be fulfillment. When I just get that, everything's going to come together and I'm going to be okay. We have all taken Doc Hudson, whatever it is in your life, and we moved him into the place of Christ, into our heart and our life. But everything that is not Christ will cease and leave us wondering why we always feel so let down. And I would say to you today that we must bring our lives and lay them down before Christ, who is the only King forever, who never ceases. Like, why do we trust Jesus? Because he came to restore us to himself. That's what he did. God extends himself first to his people. We are constantly putting our Doc Hudsons, whatever they are, it doesn't have to be, could be a literal Doc Hudson, weirdo, but we're always constantly taking our Doc Hudsons and put them in the place of God. The only way back into relationship with the ceaseless eternal King is him coming to us, laying down his life for us and renewing us as his people. And this is the beauty of what Christmas represents and these two songs. They represent the goodness of a God who has reached out to us to bring us back home, a ceaseless eternal King who ceases never, that we could never be a people who brought ourselves into relationship with him. He has to reveal himself. There's always these people who are doing these vision quests and taking this drug or that drug to find God and figure out who he is. That's not how you find God. God only comes through self-disclosure, and he has revealed himself to us in this King forever ceases never, in the person of Christ. And that is what Matthew is really showing us throughout this, that there is, in our lives, we're always trying to be the King. But the ceaseless eternal King is the one who comes. We are going to die. He goes on forever. He invites us into his family by what he did. This is every week why we come to the place of communion. It's a reminder of what our ceaseless eternal King did to bring us back from all the places that we had run from him. And so you take a cracker and you break it and you dip it in the wine or the grape juice as a reminder of his body that was broken and his blood that was shed. And we lay our lives down like the wise men laid down their gifts before Christ. It is like the coronation. You are the King. You are the King. And then we worship him. He is the one that restores us to life and hope. And this is what we want people to understand about the Christmas season. It's Jesus coming in the flesh, something that was astounding to anybody in the ancient world. And it should be astounding to us, that our God comes to rescue and save us. And if you would like prayer this morning, maybe you have something in your life, you've taken a Doc Hudson, again, not metaphor only, and you've placed that into your life somewhere in the place of Christ, like you have something sitting on your heart that has become your King. And you want to talk and pray with somebody about that. We'd love to do that. No judgment, because we've all done it and we all constantly do it. It's not like you come across something, you're like, that'll be the King of my heart, and you put it there. It's something that just kind of subtly just starts moving its way closer and closer. And then all of a sudden, that is the center of your life. And it happens all the time. We have to constantly keep looking for what that is and what our hearts are drawn towards. So if you'd like prayer, we'd love to pray with you right across the way in the lounge. You can go do your music. You can go after service, but we'd love to be able to pray with you. If you want to give, there's offering boxes on the side wall in the back. At Element, we do not pass an offering plate. We believe that our giving is meant to be in response to God's generosity first given to us. So that's why we give the way that we do. And we encourage you to grab the sermon notes, take the questions on the back of there and the activity, and begin to walk through that. Maybe being able to identify what is the Doc Hudson of your life. Is it Christ? Or is it something else that you moved into the place of Christ? And then come to the place where you worship the King forever, who ceases never. Let's pray. Father, this morning, we thank you for this season of Christmas, that we get this reminder of who you are and what you came to do, that it seems sometimes in the cultural understanding of Christmas, it's seems like this is something that's just normal. Like we look beyond the craziness of what it means that you actually came in the flesh, that you actually became vulnerable to the people you created in order to save us and bring us back to yourself. And I asked this morning that we'd see the astounding thing that actually is. and it would change the focus of what we look at this Christmas season. That there'd be a deeper joy because we see what you did to come and restore hope and life. And as we understand that, it would teach us to begin to look outward from our own lives, not to stare inwardly and say, yes, Jesus loves me. Yes, God saved me. Isn't that wonderful? Even it is wonderful. But we'd want to then give that back out to those around us, that we would respond in ways that lift up you as our King forever who never ceases. And understanding that ceaselessness of who you are, that gives us so much hope for ourselves, for others, for what eternity looks like. That we get to live in the presence of our ceaseless, eternal King who has come to redeem. So teach us to look out beyond ourselves and begin to extend that to those around us. That when we sing these songs that speak of your grace, that speak of your eternality, that would move us in new ways to worship you and extend ourselves to others. We ask that in your Son's good name. Amen. So here's, you know where the question's coming, right? So this is my question. What's your Doc Hudson? What is your Radiator Springs and Judge that you roll around? What is vying for Christ's place as King in your heart? What is doing that? And if you've never thought about it, take a couple moments and do that right now. Say, God, what right now is vying for your place in my heart? As I was praying this morning, not humble brag or anything like that. I was praying this morning before I came down here, and I just kind of laid all the things that are taking over my heart space right now. Because it happens to all of us. So say, God, show me. I come to communion and lay that down before the King who ceases never, is the King forever, and worship Him. Sing some songs, we'll head out into this world, and hopefully be more aware of the evil that Doc Hudson is. That we would worship the true King because He is good.